You were in some sense one of the guests of honour, I suppose, with the Patriarch Bartholomew sitting on either side of the Pope there. First of all, what was your impression, the atmosphere at those events?
Well, a number of people have said that the atmosphere was simply very joyful. It was very celebratory. Certainly a sense of looking back on a very remarkable series of meetings and a very remarkable initial vision from Pope John Paul II. But yesterday, I think also the whole feeling of Assisi somehow lifts the spirit.
What was your reaction to Pope Benedict's words, particularly this idea of terrorism and denial of God being the two most serious threats to our world today?
I thought it was really very interesting that he, in very typical style, did a very sophisticated analysis of, you know, different kinds of denial of God, different kinds of violence. And I think what he was driving at was a point which many people have made and which I heard in various circles yesterday. The denial of God sooner or later involves the denial of humanity, and that if you want to have a real humanism, then it has to be, so to speak, open at the top. Without that, you get the anti-humanist religion of the terrorist and the anti-religious humanism of the secularist, and they're neither of us good for us as a world.
In your own remarks, you reflected particularly on the inability that we have to see strangers as neighbours, and again, this resulting lack of dignity given to people. This is an issue very close to your own heart, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It is, and I quoted yesterday one of my favourite Welsh poets, which is possibly the first time that a Welsh Quaker school teacher has been quoted in this sort of context. But this particular writer, Waldo Williams, for him, the notion of recognition is at the very heart of what he's doing in his poetry, what he was doing as a Christian, as a peace activist. Recognition that something strikes you in the other as so like you that you cannot any longer treat them as a stranger. And that's the moment of breakthrough morally and spiritually.
There is a rumour going round that while the other delegates were all resting up during the lunch break between the morning and the afternoon events, that you and Pope Benedict were somehow able to slip off to visit a nearby monastery belonging to the Bozé community. Can you confirm that?
The Holy Father was resting, but the Ecumenical Patriarch and myself were whisked away, indeed, to visit the new house which the Bozé community has established in Assisi. And we had a wonderful half hour, very briefly, a bit of coffee and cake with the brothers, and it's only, I think, last week that this new monastery was blessed. For those of us who know Bozé, it had an immediate family feeling. It felt exactly like Bozé itself, the beauty and simplicity of the chapel, the warmth of the welcome. And about a dozen of the brothers had come down from Bozé for the day, so I'm very glad I didn't miss that, in spite of missing out on a siesta.
Is this monastery going to be used in any way for future ecumenical events?
I think it's very likely to be. It's very small, and it can accommodate a rather more limited number of people than Bozé itself, but I can see that given its location, just between Santa Maria degli Angeli and the old town itself, it's a perfect location. You're in the main streets of the old town within 15 minutes. So I think it would be a very welcoming, very nourishing environment.
The mayor of Assisi was talking about the possibility of Assisi becoming a place where peace accords, treaties were signed, trying to up its profile, if you like, in the political scene. Is this an idea that you can take back home with you?
It's certainly an idea I'd want to share around, yes. And not least because it would be a very forcible reminder that peace is not just a narrowly secular ideal. It's not simply something that people dreamed up in the 18th century as a good idea, that the truce of God was an idea that was around in the early Middle Ages, that Francis and the Franciscans were committed to this. I think it doesn't do us any harm to be reminded that some of these great ideals of reconciliation are rooted in the gospel.
Going back to Bozé, of course, the Archic III talks took place there since we last spoke. As far as I understand it, it was largely about the methodology, the kind of technical approach that will be used to the talks. But is there anything positive, any tangible progress that we can talk about that came out of those meetings?
The main bit of tangible progress, I think, is, as always at the beginning of these things, relationship building. And Bozé itself clearly played a massive role in that. Its own ecumenical profile, its own record of ecumenical hospitality made it a particularly good place for this to happen. And my sense from what I hear of the meeting is a very strong commitment to each other and the dialogue process, a very clear interest in the main lines that we've sketched out for for the subject matter of this round of Archic. So I don't think we'd have expected anything much more in the way of tangible results at this stage, except that real willingness to work at it, that real mutual commitment which makes that work possible.
In another interesting development, perhaps, between Anglicans and Catholics today, I see that the Commonwealth leaders have lifted the centuries-old ban on the monarch being able to marry a Catholic. First of all, what's your reaction to that?
My immediate reaction is that the possibility for the monarch or the heir to the throne to marry a Catholic is not something I lose any sleep over. The question, the constitutional question, of course, the tough one, is the upbringing of any heir to the throne in an Anglican environment, given that the heir to the throne will be the supreme governor under law of the Church of England. And so I very much welcome the statement that Archbishop Vincent made today in response to this announcement, in which he has recognised exactly that problem and made some supportive comments about the establishment of the Church of England. I think it's not beyond the wit of man or woman to work this through. I think that if we're quite clear that so long as the monarch is supreme governor of the Church of England, there needs to be a clear understanding that the heir is brought up in that environment, well and good. And I think Archbishop Vincent has affirmed some very important things about the common ground that we already share as Anglicans and Roman Catholics.
Do you think this might reopen the debate around disestablishment and the whole role of the monarch as the official head of the Church of England?
I don't sense there's a great head of steam about that as an issue in itself. I think the question of royal marriage is one which has understandably aroused a certain amount of popular feeling, because it looks like a simple question of justice and human rights and so forth. And it also looks like a bit of anachronistic discrimination against Roman Catholics dating back to the time when people saw the Roman Catholics as the Taliban of their day. You know? So I can see the popular feeling behind that. Oh, let's clear that up. I don't sense very much popular feeling or even political feeling or will around disestablishment as an agenda in itself.
I'd like to move on to your recent visit to Africa. Earlier this month, you visited Malawi, Zimbabwe and Zambia. What can you tell us, first of all, about the goals, the aims of that visit?
Primarily pastoral goals, of course, and from one point of view, just part of the routine of going round every year to visit some of the provinces of the Communion, and specifically visiting some of those provinces that are having a hard time, or have had a hard time recently. But the trigger of it was an invitation to Malawi to join in the celebration of 150 years of Anglican mission there. And once I knew I was going to Malawi, it seemed obvious to go elsewhere in the province of Central Africa, which meant Zimbabwe. And I'd been planning to fit that in somehow. This was a particularly good opportunity for doing it. The pattern of the visit made it possible for me to take with me to Zimbabwe the Archbishop of Central Africa, the Archbishop of Southern Africa, and the Archbishop of Tanzania, both in order to give extra comfort and support to our own Anglican people there in their present very hard circumstances, and also to make clear to the government in Zimbabwe that our concerns about human rights and the persecution of Anglicans in Zimbabwe was not just a colonial hangover and not just a sort of British eccentricity. This was something which the Anglican family was concerned about. I think their message came across quite clearly.
It was a very high-profile meeting that you had with Robert Mugabe, wasn't it? Have you had any positive developments as a result of that meeting?
The most positive development, if development it is, and we don't quite know, is that the courts have given some judgments in favour of the legitimate bishops in Harare and Manicaland. And I have a sense that the authorities in Zimbabwe may feel that the protection that they've been extending to the renegade bishops is actually not worth the candle. On the Sunday, about 16,000 people attended the Eucharist that to be celebrated in the sports stadium, and at a rough guess, 100 or so were at the rival bishop's service. I don't think that'll have escaped the notice of the authorities.
There were a lot of concerns back home in Britain, weren't there, about this meeting, that it could somehow endorse Mugabe's regime. Do you think those were well-founded fears?
I can understand the fears, and I can understand the way in which visits to any leader of that sort can be exploited, can give legitimacy. But the refusal to engage is probably in the long run more dangerous, and although, of course, it felt risky, and of course I didn't feel inherently eager meet Mugabe, it seemed that with the strong encouragement of the local church, it was important to take the case right to the president's desk, literally, and place on the table before him the dossier of abuses, if only to be able to say, no one can pretend you're ignorant about this. And I think that was worth any amount of risk, just to be able to say that.
In a way, the divisions between Anglicans there and elsewhere around the communion, do you think, in a sense, this is perhaps what the Pope was alluding to yesterday when he talked about this limited and falsified image of God that basically puts people off religion, puts people off believing?
I suspect that the Pope may have had others than just Anglicans in mind, though I'm certain he had Anglicans among others in mind. I heard him as saying, and this is about a yes to your question, I heard him as saying, it's not a good position where everybody thinks they know what Christians are against and nobody knows what they think Christians are for. This morning, we had a very fruitful conversation with Archbishop Fisichella in the Congregation for the New Evangelization, talking about precisely some of these questions and how we work together to promote a picture of what we are for. And I think, really, the events of the last 24 hours have just helped to reinforce that sense that we are genuinely for something, for the gospel.
Are you going to be particularly involved in next year's synod on new evangelisation in any way?
There are possibilities, which are not yet concrete, but I think this morning's discussion with Archbishop Fisichella means that we shall be looking for ways of cooperating, not only in the synod, but more broadly, in exchanging views and experience about new methods of evangelisation. The Archbishop and his staff were very interested in the fresh expressions of church movement in the UK. They've already had some contact with the Alpha course. So I think there are many avenues to explore there.
Finally, a question looking back to this anniversary, the 400th anniversary that we're marking of the King James Bible. Why is this such an important event for us to be celebrating?
The production of the King James Bible was in itself a sort of ecumenical event, in that it brought together people who wouldn't otherwise have spent much time in each other's company, Puritans and bishops, at the beginning of the 17th century. And I think that in itself helped it to be seen as an anchor for Christian identity beyond confessional dispute. That's one very significant, purely historical fact about it. The second thing is the obvious thing, which is repeated again and again. This is simply a work that got under the skin of the English-speaking peoples, shaped the idioms, shaped the cadences of so many writers, and to be ignorant of that is a real loss, a real lack. The third thing I'd say, and this is in a way the most difficult to express clearly, is that the language of the Authorized Version still somehow speaks to people because it feels serious. It comes from an age when there was a register, an idiom of solemnity in English, which we don't really have now. And while we don't want religion to sound quaint or just old-fashioned or old-world, nonetheless, I think we do need moments in our liturgical practice, in our reading of the Bible, when we're reminded that what we're trying to talk about is not just the business of the house and the street. It is also strange and astonishing and terrifying, and something about the language of the Authorized Version just holds on to that for us. And while I'm not recommending that we read it at every service, I think to lose sight of that way of talking about God and to God, that again would be a huge loss.
You talk about it as, in some way, an ecumenical event, and yet it was designed, as I understand it, and I'm not an expert, to somehow put the stamp of the Church of England on our reading of the Bible. Is it really appropriate that we should be celebrating that today?
As I say, it was ecumenical in the sense that within the Church of England it held together a very wide coalition of people. Certainly it was intended to push back a little bit at the Geneva Bible with its dangerously Calvinist footnotes. Dangerous because, of course, Calvinism allowed you to overthrow unjust governments, as King James I's son found out to his cost. And yes, you can see it as a bit of the flexing of the muscle of state power in the affairs of the church. But as one or two commentators this year have written about it, the surprising thing is that it escaped from that agenda. It became something much bigger.